I only have one announcement, which is that the completion card is in the back of the room for anyone who is planning on finishing the coursework, the classwork, the meditations, the reading, and reviewing the classes either in person or online. And I have not posted it online yet. If you're streaming, I will get the PDF up there so you can print it. And Donna has something.
Hey, guys. So you all have been learning about emptiness, so I know you know what a dependent arising is. And so we're very conscious at Kadampa Center that this class is a dependent arising, and having a teacher for this class is a dependent arising, and the very existence of Kadampa Center is a dependent arising. We depend on, well, we, all of us depend upon each other for this community and this center and this opportunity for study and practice exists. And part of that, well, I'm going to get myself into a wormhole if I'm not careful, but so, of course, part of what we understand when we understand emptiness and that everything is a dependent arising is that we owe it to ourselves to create the causes for those things that we want to happen to happen. And in that spirit, in the thought of emptiness, Kadampa Center has great appreciation for the people who make the classes possible, including our instructors. And so we have a little offering to thank Hemant for doing this class. Thank you.
No, I tell you what, it is dependent arising, and I'll give it right back into the Dana box.
Okay, thank you.
So, thank you. Causes and conditions so we can have more classes.
Exactly.
I kept the first one as a token, like I'll remember this one.
Okay, you guys have a great class.
Good
night.
Thank you, Dana. Have a good evening.
So, again, thank you. This is the last class of our Module 12, Wisdom Realizing Emptiness. And so, you know, we'll start with our calm abiding, do our typical motivation. And then this time when we go through the summary, which I normally go through for every class, it would be nice to kind of put a perspective on why did we do that? Why did we do this? Some of it is fundamental, basic understanding, 101 understanding, but sometimes it's good to keep a link of ultimately what is the goal, right? Is to understand what emptiness is and what is this concept of emptiness. And so, and why did we go through the class number 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and what did we get out of it? And also realize this is the discovering Buddhism. I have a tendency to get into some intermediate level thinking. It all depends on the students that we have and the interest they have. However, it is an introductory level program. I do suggest to you that if you're sincere about learning this and once you finish your discovering Buddhism, that you start to look at the basic program and other programs, and especially Keshela, and you request him. He's done some wonderful things with emptiness. My goodness, I find myself searching for those things when I'm reading through the material sometimes just to, again, get accustomed. I am still searching for those things that we learned some time back from Geshe-la. That's how good it is. So I think that I just will just suggest to you that you continue with this process and not stop. This is not something you're going to just come to 3 or 4 classes, get some few points out of it, and then go away. And I also want to encourage you to read those materials. Those are some fantastic, and I'll tell you myself. I read it through first time because it's like a requirement. I cannot ask you to read something that I haven't read. So I read it through. And then I put it away. Then it gets a little vague again. So then you pick it up again, and you start to read. And about the third time, it completely changes the meaning. You start to link things. Oh, this is what they really meant. Some things are very obvious, and some things it's like connects with you. So I would suggest to you that you read the material. It is not a lot of reading. It is a lot of thinking to do in your own mind. What is it that you're trying to gain, okay? So that's my suggestion. So before we get going, let's do a calm abiding meditation. Let's bring our mind here. We'll do just a short meditation. Okay, so keep your back straight. Legs, on, if you're in a cushion, of course, vajra position or whatever you find comfortable. Your arms are relaxed. Okay, your right hand is over your left hand and your thumbs are touching each other. Your head is slightly tilted. Your tongue is right at the palate, right on the front teeth, top teeth, behind it. Your jaw and mouth are relaxed. And your eyes are either shut in the beginning or just slightly open to keep you aware of where you are and not fall asleep. Okay? And at this point, you should start to scan your body. Just bring it here. Be in a relaxed position. And then when you feel completely all settled in, take some deep breaths. And when you inhale and exhale, just concentrate on the breath, either at the nostril or if when your abdomen is expanding. Just keep it at one point. If you find yourself just fleeting in your mind or seeing some visualizations, acknowledge them, let them go, just bring your attention back to your breath. Let's set up our motivation. So we have finally reached the last session. Remember our discipline that at the start of each session, we remind ourselves to establish this motivation that will obtain the most beneficial result of all efforts we exert here. Listen to this presentation in order to achieve supreme enlightenment, like that of Shakyamuni, so that you will be a perfect cause for the happiness of all living beings, pervading space and time. This is a lifetime practice where you go from here. Listen to many teachings on emptiness from qualified teachers and study the authoritative texts on emptiness. You really have to know the perspective of the teacher on this subject. There are many points of view on this subject, and it is important to know which one of these a teacher is presenting. Also, the books on emptiness written by authors who are widely accepted as authorities on subjects are the best choices for your study. However, it is difficult to read these books in their original language. Consequently, we rely on translations. Further, it is not likely that you will find a translation of one of those classics without a commentary supplied by the translator. Although this may sound a little bit of arrogance, it is actually very useful, as it provides the reader with opportunity to discover the particular bias of the translator, where he or she chooses a term and represents it in an equivalent or original term being translated. Also, you have to approach any book on emptiness for a particular audience, as books tend to outlive their audiences, interpretations of these meanings are required for later generations to read them. These are interpretations that claim permission from the authors of those classics, or at least from scholars of those books who have demonstrated a beneficial understanding that anyone on the path to liberation and enlightenment would want to have. Among these oral traditions are those that provide credible legitimacy to these claims of being true heirs to the understanding of the authors or realized scholars of those authors. So try your best to study a classic from someone who holds one of these authentic oral tradition, and hopefully that the teacher teaches in your language or has equally skillful interpreter. Thank you. I thought this was important motivation only because as I was thinking about it, people will read, you will find books, you will go, you know, in the bookstore and find a book on emptiness, kind of read up a little bit on who wrote it and who presented it, what is the view. There are different views out there, and of course we are in a Mahayana tradition, and we've talked about it in the class that we follow the Prasangika viewpoint of Madhyamika school, which is generally accepted by all Tibetan Buddhists and many other places. Okay, so you just have to be cognizant of that. There are different views. As it developed, there were challenges to it, and then people came up with answers and refuted it, and at the end, they came up with a conclusion that almost everybody accepts at this point in time. But it's good for you to be aware of that. So let's do a summary, okay? And we're going to summarize the same way that I have been in the past, but a little bit of linking things together. Why did we do what we did, okay? So class number one, everybody remembers what we went through in class number one, right? Very simple. We give you a little historical background, right? And we said that there are a few names. As you do your readings, you'll come across names like Chandrakirti, Shanti Deva, and Arya Deva, Nagarjuna, Lama Tsongkhapa. You're going to hear these names. And it's important for you to know who they are and what did they do. If you read Lamrim, Stages to the Path, the first thing they tell you is give credit to the teachers. Right? It keeps the authenticity. It also does another thing. It authenticates and it confirms that this teaching is not just made up, because it started with Buddha. So you can't go further than that. So it came from Buddha, and who these teachers were, you should study upon it, and how they came about, and what kind of writers they were, and how tremendous of a scholar they were, and realized beings, and especially Lama Tsongkhapa, he was enlightened. Okay, when they tell you this is the way it is, it should give you some comfort in your mind that these are some really good, these are some really good things that we have been presented here. Okay, so we went through that. We went through the lineage, then we went all the way to Shakyamuni Buddha, and then we talked about the great pandits Nagarjuna and Lama Tsongkhapa, as I mentioned, and then we talked about that there are 84,000 teachings. So good to know stuff, right? 84,000. Okay, and they are divided into three pieces. Basket of teachings of discipline, some sutras or trainings, and the last is knowledge and practice. Okay, so it's interesting. I was reading one of the invocation in the prayer book, and it says teachings of the three types. And I had Geshe, I said, I understood the whole thing, but what are the teachings of the three types? And he said, discipline, sutra, and knowledge and practice. I always knew it, but I did not link it. That's what it meant. Sometimes they'll do that. You know, Buddha of the three times. So what does that mean, past, present, and future? So when you read these things, try to understand those lines. It's amazing. It will open up. You'll start to see, I remember that. And it really is amazing. Even in invocation, it talks about bliss and void. You know, and everything becomes non-dual. Amazing. I just finished third time reading non-duality. So it makes sense after a while, even in those prayers. So anyways, don't want to sidetrack. And then we went into understanding that there are two schools or two traditions. They call a universal vehicle and an individual vehicle, or known as Mahayana and Hinayana. Right? Theravadan or Mahayana. Okay? None of them are lesser or higher. It is just named that way because you need both. But in the universal, the whole goal is for the cause and happiness of other sentient beings. That's your stamp. Whereas in the individual vehicle, just it says individual is motivated by the desire to escape samsara, self. Okay? Both are good. But it becomes better when you can go to Nirvana and have a wish to help others. Okay? That makes it Mahayana. And then we just just generally touched on what is Heart Sutra and why Heart Sutra is so important, you know, and how to be is important because it, you can develop your wisdom through those teachings. And then we talked about the mantra tayatha gate gate paragate parsamagate bodhiswa. And I also explained you the meaning of it, which we'll go through it again today. Okay, and then we got a little bit of on into how Nagarjuna came to be, that he was a young child, he wasn't feeling good, but then they did some prayers. Eventually, he wound up in Kathmandu, and he was given the message to go down to the Mer people, according to the legends, and get the Wisdom Sutras. And he wrote a lot of writings and commentaries on Wisdom Sutras, and so that's how the teachings came to us. And we also went further to say when Lama Tsongkhapa was having his meditative equipoise, Manjushri appeared to him, and he asked Manjushri, whose teachings on emptiness should I focus on? He said, Nagarjuna's. So that tells you again this real affirmation and authentication of these teachings. So we talked about that. And then we got a little bit about this use of words, avoiding sin and accumulating merit, and all that point was that as we do these good things, virtuous deeds, you accumulate merits. And we use this word a lot, getting merits, getting some good work, I'm getting some merits. Just know if your goal ultimately is to just get a higher life, nothing wrong with that. It's just that, just like the bank balance, the merits can diminish at some point, get used up. Your goal should be to get enlightened and then help others get enlightened so you don't have to go through this cyclic existence. That's the whole purpose of saying that. Okay? And we talked about that Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. Right? You need to kind of just have that as a base. And that enlightenment is guaranteed if you follow the path. So in the end, we ended the first class by saying, just go with the motivation, I can realize emptiness no matter how long it takes, and feel that spirit. The enthusiasm has to be there. If it becomes a boring subject, something technical, and all the jargon that we use to get to the point, it can become sometimes like, okay, this is good, but I'll take my time. That's okay too. But you have to continuously work at it. But remember the goal. What it is that you're trying to achieve, okay? And that's where the excitement comes from. Okay, so class two. We recited the Heart Sutra, actually. We never got into the details of it, but we recited it. Page 76 on your prayer book, actually. And then we looked at some basic concept of ignorance. Not only that, in class one, I established the base. We started by saying that why are we learning this emptiness? And what is the purpose of even coming to this class or learning this subject matter? And if you remember, I went through the two truths, the relative truth and the ultimate truth. And we talked a little bit about we live in this the reality of what we call our conventional truth or, you know, relative truth. We live with it. We see each other every day. We have brothers and sisters and jobs and all that. And we interweave and we don't realize how we get into this ignorant part of life where we get mad and upset and angry and we love something, we cling on to things, we grasp things. Why does that happen? And the only way to get rid of that way of thinking or conventional thinking is to really get deeper and know what the ultimate truth is. When you know the ultimate truth, now you can put things in perspective and all of a sudden it loosens the noose of ignorance very quickly. You don't get carried away that quickly. You don't take things very personal. You kind of see certain way and let go. It's an amazing way of thinking. Once you know that, it really does make a big difference in how you see things. But it takes practice and meditation, right? So we talked about that. So we started just talking about ignorance, and we took that apart, that brought it a little bit more into class two. We also talked about a little bit about personal identity. Who are we? Somebody were to ask you, who are you? Who are we? You know, we have to think about those things. How would you say that? So we'll talk a little bit more about it. And then we talked about the meditation. We did a meditation about transition of awareness during death. You know, we actually went through that, if you recall what you go through. Okay? And all along, we've done a lot of, I've always brought up some definitions of things because I believe that when I read personally, and I put myself in somebody else's shoe, somebody may be very educated and know these things. But when I see a word, that I don't really understand, and I can't understand the sentence properly, I need to know what that means. And then when you read it again, and it pops up again in another chapter, you can now link it. So you have a, so I always read in small chunks, walk away from it, contemplate, come back, read again, then I start to think again, and then you start to meditate on it, and you start to say, oh, I can see it now, I understand it now. Because they use a lot of the words that some of them are truly what loses us, including the word emptiness. Because we conceptually and conventionally know emptiness is like, my cup is empty. Right? I don't have any milk. My box is empty of that. So we think of like nothing. So even that word emptiness has a some sort of a seed in the mind because of language. So then we introduce things like, let's use word like selflessness, sunyata, identitylessness. Okay? There are many other words, right? Ultimate reality. See, these are all synonymous words. Dependent arising. Okay, you can use these words and also know that they are interwoven in many books or readings differently. So you can understand when somebody says, once you realize empty, then this is what happens. And you say, if it is empty, then how does it exist? But you've forgotten the point that emptiness means what? Dependent arising. So you cannot use the word void, like complete blank, when you use the word emptiness. Anyways, my point being, try to understand that vocabulary a little bit if you're studying a subject. Okay, I'm not going to read the Heart Sutra here word by word, but we certainly went through the major pieces of it, and we ended up by going through the mantra, and we explained the meaning, tayatha, thus it is said, gate, which is gone, gate, gate, gone, gone, paragate, gone beyond, samagate, way beyond, bodhi, becoming enlightened, soha, be it. So when you understand, after you will go through today some more details on Heart Sutra in the beginning, you need to always see that how that entire 25,000 verses were broken down into smaller 8,000 verses all the way down to this essence of the Heart Wisdom Sutra. And the, what is the power in it? That if you understand that, and you relate your little bit of knowledge that you've gained through emptiness, and if you say it every day or try to mention, you know, do it as your daily practice or at least regularly at some point, you will start to extrapolate more and more and more out of it. There's a lot more involved in those few four or five verses than you would think, and we'll touch it a little bit today. Okay? Okay, so again, we talked about motivation. So, you must be, have a conviction that I must develop this motivation to get enlightened. You must have that conviction if you are truly seeking that. Okay? Think of it when you want to buy a beautiful house or a new table is coming. We get excited. And we all do, right? We get excited. Where are we going to put it? How are we going to do this? That same excitement needs to be generated. You're talking about your enlightenment. So that means you need to study on what enlightenment is. Because if you somehow conventionally think this is something like this in your mind, you still don't know what enlightenment is. How can you get excited? So all I'm asking is read up these things, understand it. And you will certainly feel that juice in you then. And we also talked about that all bodhisattvas, including what we are doing, we should always practice the six paramitas or six perfections. And what are they? Generosity, morality, patience, enthusiasm or joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. And look how it leads you there, right? What is wisdom? Knowing emptiness. So when you practice this, you reach the end point is your wisdom. And we also talked a lot about bodhicitta, right? That you, while you're living and you are in this world right now and you have this opportunity, our good human life, precious human life, that you develop bodhicitta, which is what they call the practice or the method. So everything you're learning, you're taking refuge. you're going to classes. These are all, and then you practice, you're kinder to people. Or maybe, you know, it doesn't, a kinder doesn't mean that you have to be always like a doormat. Don't get me wrong. It comes from inside you. You know, anger comes inside you, and kindness comes inside you. And even Geshe-la has said, start with yourself, right? Be kind to yourself, then to your loved ones, then go out. But you will see, as you progress, you will generate a much calmer demeanor. It is just the nature of this place and the studies that we are in. It does it. Okay? And so when you do that, you're developing bodhicitta. It becomes your practice. It becomes your nature. So that is one wing. And ultimate goal is to directly perceive the phenomena of emptiness, the wisdom of emptiness. That is your wisdom wing. And what do we say in Buddhism? You need both wings to fly. So it gives you a purpose in life to reach a goal. It's beautifully put. Right? All right. Then we talked about there are two types of people. One is very analytical. One is just has a conviction. If your teacher says do it, they just do it. But you need both. And Buddha himself states, our teachers have stated, that analyze, contemplate. And what we've talked about is when you listen first, right? You listen, then your mind gets the story like, oh, this is what you, and you conceptualize it in your own way. Then you have to authenticate it by reading something. When somebody says read this or read that, they're giving you some idea of what to do, what is the next step. So you must then take time and read it. And I was talking to Jennifer earlier that it is suggested in many ways that don't go reading an entire book in one sitting and then go out totally blank. I have sometimes tendency to do that, but I find it most beneficial when I read in small chunks and walk away. Then I think about what it said. Then when I'm driving to work or when I'm doing something, all of a sudden it will come again in my head somewhere. And then I think about it. It can't be that way. Should it be that way? I contemplate on it. You analyze it. But once you know it, once you sense it, now you have a little conviction in it. And then all this later, slowly and steadily, this becomes training that authenticates the other training. Then you talk to Geshe-la, then you go to his class, then you read a book, you know, Stages of the Path. And then what happens? You start to say, I think I get it. Now you feel stronger inside. Now what happens, rather than thinking of those things, they start to appear to you, right? Like a mantra. When you first learn mantra, what happens the first 3 days? You're like, oh, do I say the Om or not say the Om? And is it Tayata or Tathagata? You start to memorize. Then after a while, you get it. Then it becomes, you can say it just like that. And sometimes you don't have to verbalize it. It's there. And then now you're looking at the meaning and the feelings that it generates. Isn't that amazing? That's how this training is. So that's why they say, take your time. Okay? There are concepts here. Some people will get it. Some people will have questions. Right? And I did clarify a few things with Geshe-la, so I will make sure that I reiterate those things, okay, today. So then we got into ignorance. So what is ignorance? Ignorance is not knowing the ultimate truth, right? If you don't know something, you're ignorant. But it does say in the teachings that it's not talking about this passive ignorance. When you say, I don't know how the transmission is put together in a car, that's ignorance, but it's not that ignorance we're talking about. Okay, we are talking about an active misknowledge of reality. That ignorance. So you can use the word ignorance in normal language, but for mundane stuff. I'm ignorant of something. That's proper English. But here we are talking about ignorance, not knowing the truth, the reality. Okay? And we gave an example of $20 bill, and then you went to buy something, and it was 1995, and you pulled out, it was only at $10. So your mind can do funny things like that, because you were either in a hurry or whatever, but it can correct itself too, which is the good news. Okay? Then we talked about misknowledge. Okay? The mental event that wrongly engages an object, just like what we just talked about, and that we can be fooled, but the good thing is we can be corrected, and what that means is we can get enlightened. speak and learn. So all these conceptual things we have because of ignorance. We think how reality is based on our knowledge, the little knowledge that we have. And when you learn these things, you have to get those things out of your system slowly and steadily. And so that's the good news, that your mind can cognize that. Okay? So it says here, while we are capable of making a mistake, we are also capable of correcting them. Okay? And why we make mistakes? Because of so many ignorant emotions, medications, hallucinations, so many things. You just think when you are upset, what happens? It just puts a veil right on you, right? Even if your mind says, I should be calmer than this, but it just takes off when you're really angry. Right? So you got to think about it sometimes. It's okay. It's one thing to be upset or not like something or correct something, but when you really impose that anger throughout your system, when you want to hurt somebody, that is absolutely not called for, right? It happens. All right, and then we introduce a new name, Dharmakirti. And he's a Buddhist philosopher and a logician. And he talked about how he logically said that there are conditions, how our minds, the way mind works, it cognizes. It just recognizes things. It wants to know things. And sometimes it can apprehend wrongfully, because you can see a bush at night and think it was a man. You can see a smoke and you think it's a fire. Or you can see a mirage and you see there's a whole oasis out there. Only then you find out it wasn't there. Again, the point is going in circle, that we can recognize it, we can correct it, and that means we can get enlightened. Okay. And it even took Buddha many lifetimes to become a Buddha. Right? And there are some who have become Buddha just like that. They can get enlightened in the same life. Okay, so these concepts we have, it will take eons and eons, and yes, it can. It doesn't matter, because you won't even know what that eon means. Or, if you can do something now, you can get liberated. So, and we came to conclusion that ignorance is the cause of destructive emotions. And we went to the 12 links very quickly. It starts with ignorance. And something appears, if we make it real, we give it a name, and then the consciousness becomes aware of it, and then all of a sudden the six senses start to get excited about it. Now we grasp and cling and contact, and eventually we cling on to it so strongly that when you're about to die, you hold on to those concepts, and guess what? It brings you right back into the samsara. And what is the root of this? What is emptiness? Is to cut this ignorance from its root. And by knowing the truth, now you know how reality is, then what happens is you start to see these views of ignorance clearly, saying, oh, geez, I shouldn't be doing this. I need to practice to get this out of my mind. You start to do those good things, and you're eradicating those problems. That's the whole point. And, okay? We talked about mind training a little bit, that sometimes even the people who are practicing Buddhists, sometimes I say that if a hardship comes to you, take it as a practice, because you can nullify that. You can also put yourself that it gives you the training that how another person feels if they're in same shoe. It gives you that compassion side. So you can take that as a practice to calm some of those emotions down. It's another way of practicing. We talked about clinging a couple of times, so I'm not going to go there. But it does say that when you are coming to the end of the life, if you associate with virtuous friends or holy people or reading the good things, or you've converted your mind to a positive thinking from a lot of negativities, then what happens is you can let yourself free very quickly, or otherwise you hold on to those thoughts. And then people are afraid. They don't know what death is like. So what they do is they become scared. Once they find out something is going to happen, they get scared. They only hold on to what they know the best. And where is your mind going to go? It's going to go to what it is familiar with. It's a common sense, right? It's going to only see what it's known to, it has always known. So that's why we learn these things, okay? So far, so good. So, chapter one, history. Then chapter two, we created a base because we are going to learn more about emptiness. So in order to understand emptiness, you need to know why we need to learn emptiness. So we have to understand, if you want to be liberated, you got to get rid of ignorance. So you need to know what ignorance is. And then in order to understand ignorance, you need to understand how these 12 links work and how these emotions and attachments and aversion create this non-virtuous minds. And that keeps us in this cycle. So you can see how the class we went through, from understanding how authentic and good the lineage of the teaching is, how the teachings were organized, where do they come from. Then we started to talk about what is it that we are going to study. You are able to see the two truths, the ultimate truth and the conventional truth, right? We understand some vocabulary in between, sunyata and all these words, and emptiness and selflessness, so you kind of identify that. So we are setting the base to really get into understanding what is emptiness, right? So that's what I wanted to do today, is to actually link all of those things. Then we actually got into the little bit of four-point analysis. And the whole purpose of this is, and I want to repeat this again, and I'll repeat this several times. Whenever we are thinking about emptiness, what we are really talking about is concreteness, how we lay concreteness onto things. You know, even when we talk about look for their eye, we are talking about this independent eye. Keep that in mind, that we are looking for something that our ignorance has created this solidness to it, that we exist from ourselves, that we don't depend on anything else, nothing is dependent arising, we just exist. That's what we are negating, because that takes away a lot of these obscurations of understanding emptiness out of the way, so then you can start to talk about then what is it, so you can look into it. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So what are four-point analysis? I'll kind of read through this. You first identify the person is misconceived by ignorance, or you're negating the object, refuting the object of that you're looking at, right? So when you look at something, you're saying, is it there or not there? And then point two, if a person existed, we're talking about us now, as misconceived, it must be findable in relationship to the body, complex, and mind. So we sometimes say this is the whole package. This body and this mind is me, the person. So then we look for it. Where is this body? What is this body? And where is that mind? Either they exist together or they are independent of each other. So those becomes the four point, and then we'll go looking for them. Okay, either they independently exist or it exists with it. And we go through the four-point analysis, and in this logic is very, very important. Geshe La even told me that there are two things you need to walk away from, and one of the most important things is the four-point analysis. You must get that in your mind. What is it that you're doing with the four-point analysis? And I would suggest to you that we have a little book, the Lam Rim Meditation Book. Have you seen those? All the different meditations are there. Gary, you have that in your thing, right? In your iPad or ebook. It's generally available. It used to be available. That's one of the best books I've seen in terms of meditations. And it has the four-point analysis, which will, if time permitting, I'll go through it. I'll make a copy for you. I have it here. Okay? And it's very important that you go through those. Okay, then we started to say, well, let's talk about emptiness a little bit. And you have to understand that they give you a lot of examples because everybody sees things differently. You might get, Anna might pick up emptiness just like that, and Patty might say, I didn't get that. And, you know, and Kevin might say, see it differently, Gary may see it differently, Jennifer may see it differently. So what they do is they give you various examples to get you to a certain point. And you're to start to that inherent feeling has to be kind of shattered a little bit, so that you start to see what they're talking about. And what did we do? We started with an example of a cup, if you remember. And if you even remember, Venerable Rabina talked about the cup, right? And so what happens is they walk you through it. They say, okay, here's a cup, okay, right in front of me. And we call it a cup. If I want to drink, I will take that cup and drink it. So, is the cup really there? So then your mind says, well, it's right there. So then they tell you, that's fine. So then they slowly take it, and now take a look at it. It has many parts. It's porcelain. It has sand particles. It has a color. Okay, it has different parts to it. What part is the cup? Then your mind says to you, all that put together is a cup. Okay? But when you break it down, there is no cupness in that cup. The only reason it is cup is because we made a contract with each other for language purposes to call something like that a cup. But if you, but the cup does exist. If you wanted to drink, that is the cup in front of me, I will drink. I cannot think of the cupness of all the potential cups out there that will help me drink it. We create this in our mind, a picture of a cup, though there are many sizes and colors, and in your cabinet you probably have 20 of those, right? So what they're trying to teach you here is look at the things the way they exist. You should accept the fact that this is a cup, but we conventionally agree this is a cup, I can drink water out of it. However, the ultimate truth is that the cup does not exist from its own side, that it is dependent arising. So there's two parts in this, right? Things exist. Because the first thing you say, if it doesn't exist, then it must be nihilism. Nobody's saying that. Things come because of dependent arising. That is what they want you to drive home. Okay? You have to keep that in mind, consistently tell yourself that, you know, things do exist. However, they don't exist the way I was thinking they existed. We thought it was a solid thing. And you have to keep on telling yourself that, yes, you are there. We named you Anna. We named you Patty. Right? But if you look for Patty as existence, you're not going to find it. It's just a convention. They have to explain it this way so that you can fully understand how the ignorant part of your mind works, that naming and making things very real, and then you attach to it. And the only way to disattach or create a normal, neutral way of looking at things is by understanding these concepts. And this is why they give you these examples. Right? So, and then basically Dharmakriti said the generalized cup or the cupness is a conceptually fabricated quality. So when you read that first time, it's like, what are you talking about? But this is what they mean. That you really don't understand how things come. Everything is like that dependent arising. Okay, then remember we talked about Harry Potter? That's a perfect example. It's completely made up story by somebody. It comes on a TV. We read a book. Now you can see the place he lives. You can see him functioning. You can ascribe a story to it, his life to it. But does he exist? What is that trying to tell you? Not that it's a made-up story. It is how our mind sees it. Our mind sees a visual. It picks up a picture, image, appearance of Harry Potter, even though he's not in front of you. Everything we do things that way. And then it becomes solid. Right? And then we get, if any of that thing you believe in to be very attractive gets swayed, you lose your temper. Okay? Or get emotional about it. Okay? Okay? And then we further broken down in the object and vase and all these kind of things. And if you look into the particles can go into nanoparticles, and you cannot really measure non-particles. And you can go into deep study, and I'll have you have had this. You can take a book and read about that. But you get the point, right? That's when Venerable Robina says, you're with me. You get the point. Are we communicating? And then we took another example of a rainbow. A great example, right? You see the rainbow when you go in, so we even take a picture of it. I take pictures of it. It's beautiful. We ascribe to it. It's gorgeous. But when you really look at it, does it exist on its own? Then the scientific mind, you know, Gary would say, well, it's the moisture and the light hitting a certain refraction, and that's what rainbow comes out. Again, shows rainbow is dependent on those two things, only to find out those things were also dependent on other things. So things do appear. Things do happen. They come into being, however, they don't exist on their own. Just keep that in your mind. And they'll go, it's a part of phenomena. Another piece that comes to my mind, and I want to see this for the last class, take a look at the ocean. You see the waves? Then you see this big wave. Even name the crest of the wave. It's a crest. Then it falls down, it comes to the beach, and it goes back to the ocean. You cannot say wave did not exist. But it's like a phenomena. Things come up, we label things. We even see the aquamarine color ocean, and we see the dirty part, and we see the horizon part. We name it for convention purposes, because that's how we communicate. But when we do those things, we label it and becomes a real. But if you look at it, where does that crest go? It was never different than the water it was. It goes right back into it, but we label that. It's again trying to get you to that basic understanding that that's how we communicate, that's how we conventionally make things up, and then when you do that, you start to lose the scope of truth of how things are, and then you start to put a solid concreteness to it, and then all of a sudden it becomes real, and when somebody says that's not real, you're like, wait a minute, what about me? What about him? That's what happens. Okay? So then, there are many examples like that, and we can go on and on, but the last one we talked about was countries and boundaries. You know, and we made a joke that the birds that fly to Mexico don't know this is Mexico. You know? We make that up. There is nothing there. Only we make a boundary. We type it up on a map, Google Map, and say that's Mexico, and so that's conventionality. If you look it from the sky, you know, your mind will say, oh, that is Mexico, oh, that's United States. But it's just a piece of land you see continuously and some ocean, but we put some labels on it. It's how we do things. Okay, then we did a meditation on I. We looked for that I. Rightly, we were looking for that I. We couldn't find the darn thing. Okay, any questions so far on how we've covered some of these classes and why?
Thank you, Kim. Something that I was just checking out the other day as an example of emptiness, the relationship between a father and a son. So the father could not be a father if there is not a son, and the son could not be a son if there is not a father.
Mm-hmm.
So this connection, no, between things that are dependent, not only arising, dependent between themselves, no? So the father depends on the son, and the son depends on the father. And none of those exist by themselves. So I could not call something a father if there is not a son, and vice versa. So, but this is another relationship, I don't know, in terms of the concept, that is connected with another thing, which is the thing that is depending.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
No? Yeah, and you know, Geshe-la clearly says, mother sentient beings. We were connected. We are connected. You were sometime, maybe my father, my mother, I was yours. I don't know. But they say these words because in conventional life, we do have this relationship. We ascribe a lot more emotions than we should, but we do, and it happens. But you need to know what it is in its truth. It's normal to have that relationship. Your son depends, that's your duty, you do it, it's fine. But then how much emotionally are you tied? There are mothers that lose their children at early age. There are, you know, there are so many stories of exaggerated views. It is a responsibility, they are dependent on you, that is your duty. But yes, this everything is dependent arising. We depend on each other all the time. We, even in the developing, the establishing the daily practice, we talk about you eat an apple. You don't realize how that apple came to you. We are dependent on the person that put it in the truck, the farmer that grew it, the person that cleaned it. You can go on and on, but there are different levels of real relationship. But you're right. Those are dependent. We are depending on each other. But when you look at microscopically of who you are as a person, that dependent arising is what we are talking about, is how we think this hand is real, but then when we look for it, it's just a label. Even the father and the son is a label. If you think about it, it's a label, but conventionally you put those labels to have communication. right? Nothing wrong with that. Thank you so much. So you're right. It's okay. It's good thinking.
Geshe-la said there's two things that we should know when we leave. What's the other thing?
Okay. So there's always this question about, you know, we want something part of us that we truly believe exists to continue. And that thinking is that when I go here, I'm going to still be that me part of it. Right? So how do you explain that to people? Then you use words like, oh, there is this subtle consciousness. And those words are used, the gross, the subtle, and the very subtle. It's every, you can read it. But when you really, really deeply look into it, I talked with Geshe-la about that. And he says, Hemant, it is called mere self. It's called mere self. He says, the reason to understand emptiness is to understand that we put this concreteness to things. We don't realize that everything exists because of dependent arising. And we also forget that when we use the word emptiness, we things don't exist. But it's very clear, even if you look at the essence of the Heart Sutra, it says, emptiness is form, form is emptiness. Because we use the word empty as somehow in mentally a picture of it, does something does not exist. That's not what it's saying. Things do come into place because of emptiness, because there is dependent arising and cause and effect. And so that is the part. The mere self is the base. You cannot even put a word on it, really, honestly speaking. Even by saying something is subtle consciousness and then tells you, it's a misconception takes place that some part of you that concretely exists goes on. So, but there is the base self of you that that is the one that carries your seeds of karma. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. You do an action, there's an effect of that action. That continues on. It's been there, beginless. It is the phenomena. It is it. So you cannot really put a name in. What he said to me is, don't need to go there. You don't even need to know that. Just understand that you need to meditate on emptiness. You need to truly, truly understand the concept of what is dependent arising and emptiness. And when you do that, when you have a correct understanding of it, this will come to you. This will automate. You will start to sense it. That there is something there, but I cannot just say, I want to label it somehow. You want to carry it in a bag and saying, here, this is what it is. And that's not how you want to see things. So you told me that.
But if consciousness has existed from beginningless time, and there was no separation among, then when there was enlightenment, all would be enlightened, right?
No. So don't look at consciousness as a package. So you put a word, consciousness. So you then think it's this thing called consciousness. You can think of moments. You can think of that mere self as just the base of what phenomena is, if you want to call it part or whatever you want to call it, whatever that's what it is, phenomena itself, it continues. You know, we have that mere self, and that once you learn, when you get to dependent arising more deeply, you will find out how things dependently arise, but it arises because of cause and effect. You cannot be cause and effect together. The cause, effect is dependent on the cause, cause is dependent on the effect. Okay? So things happen because of some causes and conditions, and your actions are the causes, and it has an effect. That is part of the phenomena of all things. There are so many things taking place at one time that we want to put things in a linear way. Me, I, and I move on to from A to B, B to C. There are combination of things going on from various times and places and conditions that can work on this phenomena of you, the mere self. And I would suggest that there is a book, and I'll tell you exactly what I did. I went crazy trying to read about it. And I found some things in the Burzin Eye archives that very nicely talks about how to see things. He gives you examples of looking at a movie and each frame. Each frame is part of a movie, but it's not the movie. And he goes into a lot of these examples to get you to the point, and then he talks about how things appear in the first place to your mind, and then what happens and how you label it. But this is not the purview of this class. The idea is to understand that the way we see things right now, we see things concretely, and we think that this is I, me, and I exist. And when you see that, there's a lot of ignorance involved in it. And when you start to understand the true nature that you are, there are a lot of causes and conditions, cause and effect, that brings you about of what you are. Then, and you also need to know, because of cause and effect and dependent arising, forms are there. If everything was static, there is no form. Nothing would be, you cannot have a product without a cause. So because of these changes, there is a product. Right? But how that product exists is the question. The product, we want to ascribe a solidness to it. Whereas all along it's saying that it's dependent arising and it does not exist inherently. It's all the emptiness. And so when you see things, you interact with things, you be kind to each other, you recognize it, you're not going to take things solidly because now you know many conditions that causes that person to do what they're doing. And so you see it things differently. That's the main purpose of this class, introductory level. Now, if you really wanted to dig into this, I suggest you take the Tenet class, right? And you take the basic program. And it starts to really talk about mind-only school and how we posit and what is imputed on the mind and a cognizer that imputes these things. And it goes into such details of what is base line, and then how things get put on top of it. And the Prasangika view is very clear of a mere self, and that it's in a middle way, and emptiness means there is form, and dependent arising means that things are not inherently exist, otherwise they would not be depending on each other. So these are the two extremes that are negated, that nihilism is an error because we are here, something happens, something is going on, it's just how we see each other, how we understand each other, how we see things. That's what needs to be clear, and that is the knowledge of emptiness that this class is supposed to be talking about. So I want to make sure that I was going to say this today, because I myself, after Kevin asked me a question and he had posed a question, I started to think, and I kind of had it in my head, but I could not verbalize it properly. You know, because if you come in a class, your mind says, oh, yeah, I got it, and now say it. Mm-hmm. Because if you say it wrong, people will take it in a wrong way, or they may perceive it wrong. I want to make sure. So what I did was I called up Geshe-la, and I talked with him for a while. I said, I'm still a little lost in it, but I understand the basic concept. And he says, Hemant, just know that, yes, you're there, you're sitting in front of me, so that's your mere self. But what happens is, when I see how Hemant is, big, bad, good, ugly, this, that, I'm ascribing qualities that are not part of. And then he gave me an example of when you're going through a cliff, what is it that's falling, your body or I? You know, and he wanted me to think about it. He says, think about that. So we need to recognize there is something, right? But you have to be careful of how you subscribe to this solid concreteness of yourself. And then you have to view things in a certain way. And that is how you want to understand emptiness. And when you understand truly the emptiness and the phenomena, it's amazing how your view changes of everything. Everything becomes a little neutralized. It's okay to say this is a chair. I can say this is a book I'm teaching. You're sitting. Perfect conventionalities. We make up these things to communicate, and those things are taking place. It is how we see things and ascribe to it. We start to put taste on it, color on it, shape on it, and, you know, big, small on it. That's what we need to be careful of. Okay? Okay. Go ahead.
I got to go back to this question again. So now we have I understand that getting away from I, and we've got a new label now, mere self. Is mere self aware of itself? What cognizes? What actually goes on and gets enlightened? Is it mere self?
Yeah. So cognize, your mind is the mind is all knowing. If you understand, do you know that three words that describe mind? Clear, aware, and mere. Okay? So then you need to then study what that mere means. At its base, it's what is its function? To know, to apprehend. Right? That's its function. So part of the phenomena, that continuum is there from right there. It exists in that way. And then when you start to see a sunrise, then you say, oh, you don't know yet. But then somebody says, oh, this is dawn and how beautiful it is. Now all of a sudden, your mind is already latching on to the sunrise and the colors and everything, right? So that's how it will automatically get by nature do that. The idea is it's very hard to undo some of this ignorance to that level. Even if you stay away from, that's why when the bodhisattva reaches the state of meditation, they're single-pointedly focused on that. Okay, and that's how they're able to consistently stay in that. It takes many, many, much practice and meditation to be able to fully that. So yes, that is why they don't want to have a label on it. It's because Geshe Laivan said, he says, don't need to go there. It says, just know that there is, from beginless time, moments before moments, go on ever, infinitum. There is part of that mere self that continues, which causes, if cause and effect, karma takes place, and it goes and puts up its causes and effect. It recognizes in whatever shape or form it is born, it has the consequences of some of those actions or habitual energy, you know, and it's not necessarily that you did X, Y, and Z, so you're going to have Y, Z, you know, A, B, and C here. Could be many things and many combinations. Also, good things come with it, right? So this is a phenomena. Everything has a cause and an effect, and that's why it's dependent arising. And if everything is dependent arising, these things continuously are taking place. The only way out of it is you completely eradicate emotion and you become equipoised like the bodhisattva, and the mind goes to its basic function of all knowing and become Buddha, right? And this is just trying to tell you, in this conventional world, we don't see the truth. And we need to see the truth to cut the root of ignorance and to get liberated. So we can have that conversation. I did a lot more studying after your question because I kind of know it in my mind because I've read it many times, but I was trying to nail what book where and how does it explain what happens, how does the appearance come, what is that appearance, where does that first thought even come? So whole discussion, but that's a mind and its potential, and then we can talk about that. But for this class purposes, you should at least know that form exists because of emptiness. Emptiness is form, form is emptiness. Take the meaning, people get confused with the word emptiness. Empty to them means nothing. So I want to emphasize the fact, when you think of emptiness, it is the phenomena of dependent arising. So use another word if you want to. Okay, that is the phenomena. And if things were static, they would need to be exist. There would be no cause and conditions for a product to be done. It is there by itself. And it gives you a good example, and I'll go through it in a minute, but I'll tell you right now, for example, when you see a small tree being planted or a seed, do you see the tree there? It's a seed. It will need what? Water, warmth, some sunlight. But we conventionally know that if the right conditions exist, it will become a tree. It may not, but that's how we convention. So those are conceptual conventionalities. But when you're looking for the tree does not appear like that.
Yeah, one thing is in
one way, why we are talking about emptiness, and you say, okay, I am not having independent arising. No, I depend on other things. So, what is the conclusion? You say, well, it don't make sense to say this is mine. This is my home, this is my chair.
Those are attachments.
It's wrong because the I is not independent, no?
So
when I am saying this is my home, this is my money, it's wrong because...
No. Let's stop right there. Conventionally, that is your home. There's a car parked out there, it's yours. That you're wearing that shirt, that is yours. I'm not denying that. Nobody's denying that. It is just a view. If you get attached to it.
No, but I'm talking about the ultimate reality, not the conventional.
So an ultimate reality is the way things exist. It's okay. You recognize that this is my home. Fine. Right? But you also must recognize that home is not permanent.
No, I'm talking when you are not talking about the conventional reality. When you are talking about the ultimate reality.
Okay.
At that level, I am not, it not make sense to say I.
Correct.
No? So how could I say this is my, because I am not I.
So here's
the I doesn't exist.
I got it. I know it. So this, let's take a look at it. What does convention mean?
The convention is the chair. I am saying the chair.
No. Convention means we agree with each other what to call something. We agree that I'm going to call this a shirt, and you will call this a shirt, and we'll call this a book, and we'll call this a table. We agree as community, as a group, that is a convention. So conceptually, you ascribe this thought or projections, right, in your mind. So it is perfectly conventionally normal to say, yes, please come to my house. But when you are thinking about it, a house, my house, it's okay to meditate and look at it and says, it is impermanent in nature. Everything is impermanent in nature. And maybe that will help you say, I don't want to get hooked onto my house. When you're dying or something, what will happen to my house? What will happen to my jewelry? What will happen to my expensive watches? Those are the attachments we create because we don't understand the ultimate nature of things. But when you start to understand ultimate nature of things, it is a little complex in that you have to meditate. And when you meditate more and more and more and focus onto emptiness, you will realize the nature of things, how things exist. Buddha is the ultimate realizer of emptiness, and he becomes a Buddha, enlightened.
This is one. The other one, Hemant, is when you say, okay, I'm going to go to another life, no? So what is the thing that is, in one way you are saying there is no I.
No. I just mentioned that.
And then you pass to your life and suddenly you have all the karma, no?
Okay, so here, let's just clarify that. And that's why I spoke with Geshe-la, and as I mentioned to Kevin this afternoon, he said that the mere self, the phenomena, this is why you need to understand the phenomena. What is the word phenomena? And how things work in this phenomena. Everything is in there. The whole universe and beyond, everything is part of the phenomena. How things come to be, and how things disappear, and how things move on. So there is something that has, it goes on from whenever to now, and it's called mere self, according to Geshe-la. It's called mere self. It's part of the phenomena. Okay? Now, then you have to learn about what happens to that mere self. It gets into how does the first thought appears when you take the life, or when that mere self posits onto a sperm and an ovum, a life takes place. This birth and death cycle is part of that phenomena. Things will come and things will go. Things will come and things will go based on causes and conditions. That's part of it. It is the recognizing of what it is that becomes real for us. We project things onto things. So you need to know what goes on. So you're trying to put a concrete, like I was telling you, linear. What do I take so I can recognize that this was me, and now this is me, and the next life this is me? It doesn't work like that. But there is a mere self that has none of this connected, but the karmic seeds are the essence of what you've been practicing, is the action. When you do causes and effects, when you do this karma, any kind of karma, your constant thoughts, your constant mind, that is what makes that self propagate towards, or propel towards a somewhere where it finds that as a comfort, where it's what it needs to know, that's what it knows, that's what it will become. And that's why they tell you to do virtuous actions. That's why they tell you to have friends with the virtuous people. So what this will do is it will go into We have to learn karma and mind and its potential and how appearances come together to put this entire piece together. All you need to know is that the way things exist right now, we are not saying things don't exist. We are saying we simply don't understand the way it exists. So that's where you need to read and understand that what does that mean? When we say emptiness is form, what does that mean? Read that. And what will happen is, at some point, you will meditate on it. Like you're thinking right now, something goes on. What is that? You want to right now label it. You want to see that that part of me continues. Right? And that's the latching on we have. But when you recognize that, how things change, you will realize how next life takes place, how karma ripens, and how mind works. All right? And we can talk about it on a different level because I want to continue this. But do know that those thoughts are very valid points. Those are not some crazy questions. We must all come to those terms. Right now, know the fact that emptiness, there's two parts. Things are not concrete, and things are not empty or nothing. Things do exist. It's the way we see it. It's dependent arising and origination, right? And because it's dependent arising, it cannot be concrete. It needs a cause and effect to become.
And it's a phenomenon.
Yeah, and the product cannot be made if it is static. It is it then. It doesn't need anything. And if it does not, does not exist, it never existed. So that's what we have to get in mind. That's a really nice way of, sometimes it's hard to explain, but when you read some of these words, they come out very good. So let's see, we have a lot of time.
Could I just ask you a question, please? So because we, could you just touch on suffering? In other words, because we hold on so concretely to all these feelings and the I, we suffer, right, because of that. And so is suffering a purification? It kind of, I mean, if we've had enough suffering, it kind of forces us out of that box.
Well, suffering is an effect of some cause, right? Because suffering is an effect of a cause.
Because there's a lot of suffering.
Right, so it goes on and on. The only thing you can do is meritorious things, virtuous action, purification practices, you know. And that's why they said that when something is going on, you're burning your karma, right? Why do they say that? It is an effect of your karma. So you're burning it up.
So it's a purification.
You can, there's a better way to see it than to dwell in a depression. Correct?
Thank you.
All right, so what we'll do is, I think, just sidetracked a little bit here. Let's take a 10-minute break. Go to the bathroom, relax your mind, and we'll continue. I got it. Wasn't all the way. Okay, and lastly in class 5, we did talk a little bit about dependent arising. We started with the three aspects, principal aspects of the path. And if you kind of remember three aspects of the path, guys, from your previous classes, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. And even what Lama Tsongkhapa said to us, that you can get bodhicitta and you can become renunciate, or you can even get renunciation, I should say. But it is the emptiness that will get you enlightened. So again, emphasizing the importance of emptiness. And so we started talking about dependent arising is a king of reasons, according to Indic conventions of the old Indian philosophers. They used to give names to everything, just like we give names to a lot of our musical notes and things like that. And it's because the lower person, like a postman or something, had to take permission from the king to make it, to have something, to make something happen, or give permission. In this case, because it came from Buddha, it's called the king of reasons, that, you know, why things are the way things are. And so they always call that, when we talk about dependent arising, they say it's the king of all reasons, king of reasons. They give names like that. But before we go into a little bit further into dependent arising, I do want to not forget the fact that we did a little bit of the Heart Sutra, and I was leading you through the Heart Sutra. I don't want to lose that, so I'm going to do that right now. And if you remember where we were last time, that class 2 or 3, we read the Heart Sutra, we went through what it is a little bit, but we really didn't connect with some of the paragraphs properly. And in order to do that, what did we do? We first, there were a question about what are the five aggregates. And some people took notes. If you remember them, you can say them right now, right? Form, feelings, discrimination or perception, mental formation or compositional factors, and consciousness. Okay? Each has a definition. Matter is made up of the four elements, form. Okay? It's empty of inherent existence. We are not saying it does not exist. Keep that in your mind. We are not saying it's inherent existence. Things come off dependent arising. Keep that clear in mind. Feelings, perceptions, all come because of something else. You know, we remember a given example, we look at a pillow, and it's not just a round material anymore. It's round, and it's flat, and it's a burgundy, it's like it, and maybe it needs cleaning. Or we start to put things on it, and we haven't even touched it yet. Our mind is constantly doing that. So Sariputta and Avalokiteshvara are having this conversation. We started with the fact that the way the sutra is written has a prologue, and it talks about this prologue of four conditions that were available, the excellence of the time. So it tells about at one time, I heard at this time. Then the second one was the excellence of the teacher. The Bhagwan was dwelling on the excellence of the place, Rajagira. So they are just talking about that the place was right, the time was right? Basically setting the stage. And then there was an uncommon prologue, and it says here that at the time Bhagwan was absorbed in a concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. And profound perception means what? Emptiness. Okay? See, so this is a good way to know. Profound refers to emptiness from the subject side, and profound appearance is the wisdom that realizes emptiness.
Perception means awareness.
Right. Right. So here's Buddha himself engaged in complete concentration of emptiness. And because of that, what happens, it's a very good way it shows here, that the power of that Buddha inspires this conversation between Avalokiteshvara and Sariputra. Okay? So you can see that the whole, how this whole thing is coming together, just like on the stage, right? Right location, right time, Buddha himself is completely profoundly realizing emptiness, and that inspires this environment of all the bodhisattvas and arhats and all these other realms, from different realms, beings that are there. They are now profoundly, they are experiencing the inspiration in this conversation between Avalokiteshvara and Sariputra. So then the question comes out. The very first one that he says is, of course, Avalokiteshvara, when he was responding to the question, he did it for two types of responses, for ordinary people and for higher ability people. People with ordinary faculties and higher. So he was doing two things, and we can talk about that a little bit. The first one, he's talking about the way to... There are five paragraphs, five pieces in Heart Sutra. The first one is the first section accomplishes the path of accumulation and path of preparation. Let's talk about that a little bit. Bodhisattvas go through five stages before they become Buddha. Path of accumulation, path of preparation, then it's called path of seeing, then path of meditation, and ultimately path of no more learning. Okay? So those are the five paths. Each of these sections in the Heart Sutra is associated with the level of that path. Okay? So when we say things like, so we'll go through it. So we talked about the five paths. Okay, so having been asked in this manner, Avalokiteshvara responds to Sariputra and says, Sariputra, any son and the daughter of this good lineage who desires to practice this profound Prajna Paramita or wisdom sutras must do as follows. Realize that even the five aggregates themselves are empty of inherent existence. That's how it starts. So we talked about form, feelings, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. Five aggregates are empty of inherent existence. They don't come about themselves, the dependent arising. Okay? And in this is included the path of accumulation and path of preparation. And I'll tell you which one. It says form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than the form. And form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Five aggregates. Right? So now let's talk about it. So when he says, the first statement, form is empty, what is it empty of? Inherent existence. You see, it's saying that, right? So think about emptiness again. Not void. Not blank. Dependent arising. Okay? So, and what happens is, it goes to further explain that because of this living beings, us sentient beings, we don't realize this, that form inherently, we believe that form inherently exists. Okay? And that generates what? Attachment and aversion. Displeasing of your friends, family members, and then love and hate and all that, right? So that's why it says form is empty. All problems arise from not understanding that. So then we are told that form is empty of the true existence or lacks inherent existence, then people fall into the wrong view. They start to think if form is empty, then nothing exists. That is wrong. And to make sure that that is not taken in that way, it goes on to say to eliminate this nihilism, he says, this is to show that it's emptiness that appears as a form, and having said that, form is emptiness. It's the second word is form is emptiness. So what does that mean? Form is emptiness. So, form is empty of inherent existence, but emptiness is form.
That's form is a dependent arising.
Correct. And emptiness, the phenomena of emptiness, because of dependent arising, forms appear. Correct? Because things are static, you need a cause and an effect for a product to be there. Correct. And again, it says, in other words, emptiness appears as a form, or the appearance of the form itself is emptiness. This is to show that there is a way that form does exist. It is not simply non-existent. It is the emptiness that appears as form. Now, you get it a little bit? You got to think about that, okay? Okay, so in the end, there are no two separate truths. All reality is one entity, phenomena. That's not this duality. This is that and this is that. It's not. It's all. When you think of emptiness, all of these things we are talking about, interchangeable word, like that gentleman asked me, why don't we just call it dependent arising? Okay? But there are ways to explain certain things because there are phenomena you can explain a certain way, but in fact, it's dependent arising. Okay, so that's one thing. Now let's go to the next step. Sariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness without characteristics, unproduced, unseized, stainless, all this, it goes on, right? So what does that mean? So we're saying this is, so for the first two that we talked about, the first one we talked about, includes path of accumulation and path of meditation, and path of preparation. And the reason is, first you're hearing these things. Then you're questioning, what are those five aggregates? What is dependent arising? Then you meditate on it. So then it's just called preparation. Okay? So bodhisattvas accumulate this knowledge, then they contemplate and meditate, they prepare for it. Now, they're going to get into seeing it. Emptiness. So here it says, Sariputra, likewise, phenomena are all empty, without characteristics. This is a path of seeing. And why is it a path of seeing? Because they are directly perceiving emptiness. They are directly perceiving emptiness at one point meditation. There are still some obscurations there, but generally they're one point and they're seeing it. And they're, when they're in a meditation, at one point meditation, these things don't appear in meditative stabilization. You just are in purely seeing the phenomena, and so things don't appear concrete with labels.
It's kind of like burned?
No, it does not appear. You just close, you do a meditation right now. Are you thinking about your toes and head and hair and all that? When you get into a good meditation, you will see a level of bliss come over. But remember, this is a much higher level you're talking about, okay? So that's why it says here in that all phenomena, and they talk about a couple of defilements. I'm going to go through it. I'm going to not take too much time, but I will discuss this a little bit. So there are eight qualities that show the practice of this wisdom, okay, and indicating the three doors. So when they talk about each of these things, there is no, not only form, feeling, but we talk about stainless, seizing, non-seizing. These are these qualities, and all this is talking about is when you see something, take example of a pen, a writing pen or whatever, a cup or pen, you have to first recognize it's dependent arising, it's the empty of inherent existent. It came from parts. The causes that made that pen also are dependent arising. So the causes are empty of inherent existence. And the results are also empty of inherent existence. This is just a way of explaining it to you that there is a difference between something that exists from its own side versus things that are consistently depending on other things. This is just, it takes you to the next level. And when you are poised in meditation, you're able to see that the causes, the product, and the results are all empty of inherent existence. Okay? And then they give names to these things. If you study a little more, you will see it's called the signlessness. The emptiness, the silence, and wishlessness, and all it means is causes, the emptiness itself, and the results are all empty of inherent existence. Then the next thing, it goes, no tongue, no body, no eyes. This is where people get scared. When I first read this, I said, I don't want to be enlightened. But here's what it talks about, okay? After you read it, you understand it. This is path of meditation continued. So when you say, therefore in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no composition factors, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, all this. This is what it is saying. This practice of path of meditation then is about the cessation, or when we talk about cessations and no part and exalted wisdom and all that, what happens is you're meditating on emptiness. And when you're meditating on emptiness, all these factors don't affect you in any shape or form. They don't come to your mind even. Okay?
Because it's all limited.
Well, it says because the mind stabilized on emptiness perceives only emptiness. It's a hard one because we are not there. But you can at least conceptualize one-pointed meditation on phenomena of the nature of how things are. When you're seeing there, you're not going to label things. When you see something, you're going to know it's dependent arising, it's part of the phenomena. So that's why they're not saying, oh, the I don't hear the sound. It's me meditating, even that me and you, there's no duality. They are one-pointed meditation. So you got to think about that. But it explains it here, the path of when the bodhisattvas are going closer and closer to Buddha, how close they are to the phenomena at all time. And after that, they go into even a higher state of pure meditation. Even path of seeing is beginning to see it, but there's still a little bit of some left, obscurations left. But when they go into the last phase, they talk about six inner media, the sense powers, the eyes, ear, nose, the six outer sounds, object, and taste, and all that is not there anymore. They know about it, but they're not, it doesn't come to their mind. It's pure emptiness in front of their eyes. At that point, when it talks about no attainments and also non-attainments, so think about it. When you reach that state of mind, there is no label about it. You are attained. For us, there would be attainment. But when you are attained in that stage, there is no attainment. You are there already. Right? Makes sense or no? because it's all about mind and recognizing and cognizing. When you are an enlightened being and you're sitting there in pure knowledge, do you need to know what is attainment? You are attainment. So that's what we see. And then in the end, it's really a path of no more learning. You become a Buddha. You are enlightened. There is no more learning. And so this goes on, and that's why they use this beautiful mantra, tayata gate gate paragate parsamagate bodhisattva, right? And in the end, there's an epilogue. This is confirmed by Buddha rejoicing. He basically says, the Bhagwan arose from the concentration and commended the bodhisattva, well said, son of my lineage. What is he saying? He is again authenticating that this thought and conversation is true. And everybody rejoiced. So this entire Heart Sutra is really amazing to see how the location, the teacher, the environment, and then how it takes you to the first step of learning about the aggregates, and how the first step of a bodhisattva, then you get into the path of seeing, and you go into meditative, and you start to see that other things doesn't come in your way, and then you get to the point where you are fully engrossed in meditation, then these things don't matter anymore, and then you become enlightened, and you don't need to learn all of this. Make sense? Okay, so I wanted to make sure we go through that. So that is why Heart Sutra is the essence of the Wisdom Sutra, the mother of all sutras, because it talks about wisdom of emptiness. Okay? So read about it. There is a beautiful, the Wisdom Archives, Lama Yeshe, has a great write-up on this. I have a book called The Essence of Heart Sutra. If you're really interested in going into details of each and every word of it, it will tell you what those are. There's books written on it. There's a Lama Zopa. There's another one I have. I'll share with you later on. Read it if you want to really understand Heart Sutra. It goes a lot. Remember, it was 25,000 verses to 8,000 to this small little place thing. So there's a lot more to it. Okay? But I wanted to make sure that we cover this properly. So, a little bit about dependent arising I do want to talk about is that, you know, whenever we give examples in emptiness classes, people talk about, we talk about rainbows and cups and the trees and the seeds. It is for people to understand logic. And the word for logic is what? Syllogism. Okay? Syllogism is Aristotelian in nature, and I'll tell you, for example, when I say the word that all dogs are animals, all animals have four legs, the logic is what? Therefore, dogs have four legs. Right? So you can say all dogs are animals, all animals have four legs. I mean, all dogs are animals, all animals have four legs, therefore the dogs have four legs, because dog is an animal. So this is, they use this because if you are working in a lab and you can visualize something, you can put it in a tube and look in under a microscope and saying, okay, let me take a sample and I can see a microbe. Oh, there's a microbe. But when you talk about phenomena, when you talk about some of these concepts that you cannot put in a bottle or a test tube, you have to create structure for with a logic in it, so it provides you a way of confirming, because even when I say about emptiness, there are some people that will conceptualize it probably in a certain way. Some of them will conceptualize it a different way. We still get the point, but we are still struggling with some pieces of it. Okay? But what the syllogism does, it allows you a very structured way of saying, it's, if this is not there, and if this is there, then it must be this, or it's not that. Then it walks you through some logic. And that's why a lot of the readings people get put out after they read two pages, like they fall asleep, because it talks you through some. But some of this logic is important for us to be. There's a conviction in it, right? That if you believe it, then let me see the truth. How does it come to that point? That's why they use syllogism, and that's what it is. So we talked about King of Reasons and logical proof, and then they say that if you have to have a, when you're going to say a syllogism to somebody or mention it, you need to have a right type of population. Couple of things about the people who are listening to this, that you cannot have a person listening to a syllogism that doesn't even understand the language. For them to understand, they need to know what is it that you're looking for. Like thesis, if you have a hypothesis or a thesis, you have to have some solid ground to say, this is what we are trying to prove or disprove. You need to have a statement. Also, you cannot have so many preconceived notions. You gotta come, may have some doubts in you. So when you're sitting down, you have little doubts, and then you walk through some logical way to say, aha, that is why it is that way. Now I get it. This is why they use a lot of syllogisms. So this is a valid reason or a logical proof, they call it. So any question on what is a syllogism? So it says that the knowledge of logic provides you with keys to build the right views. So that's what it is. So what is our syllogism here today? For example, when we say the person does not truly exist because being dependent arising. So you make that statement. A person does not truly exist because they are dependent arising. So now you've got to prove that. How do you prove that? So they go through this thinking about, let's talk about this a little bit, and it will show you why it is that way. So they typically jump right to the cup and the cupness examples. Okay? But I will cut that out because we already know about cup and the cupness a little bit. But here's the one. They say that there are three types of dependent arising. Three types. Things arise out of, they originate from causes and conditions. That's one way to look at it. That they depend on their parts on a mundane level. We'll talk about that. And they are constructed with words and thoughts. Okay? This is how things come to be. Let's talk about that. We'll still have to touch that clay in a cup a little bit. You already know that the cup does not come from its own existence. It comes from parts. Different parts, and eventually it's dependent arising. And then we can talk about a blade of grass. So a seed transforms into a blade of grass, right? The blade of grass does not just appear. You need to have a seed and it appears, but it needs what? Causes and conditions. It needs warmth, needs moisture or water, right? So and need a light for that seed to grow into a blade of grass. Causes and conditions, okay? Then they talk about these conditions are themselves causes of transformation for the seed to become a grass blade. And the cause and effect never exist simultaneously. You need a cause for an effect to take place. But they can't be one. You can't be cause and effect at the same time. Cause does, ceases, effect takes place. They're dependent on each other. This is a logical way of walking you through, guys. We already know commonsensically that cause and then it has an effect. Okay?
And also have another.
Yep. It continues. Everything has more things going on. This is just the initial step. Then depending on causes and conditions, it will have causes and effects of those.
There can be many conditions.
Correct. That is absolutely right. Next sentence. That there are many conditions, causes and conditions for that effect to take place.
So there could be no effect without a cause.
Correct.
There's
got to
be a cause.
Correct. So when you say things are being made, for a product to happen, for any kind of product, what do you need? A cause. And the effect is the production of a person or whatever that is. Now, you cannot, like he said, what Jack said is, it's not one-to-one relation. Many. For that seed, it needs warmth, light, moisture, many conditions, right? Or many causes, sorry. So it could be multiple causes. And then it does get a little bit, I was reading this and whenever we were putting it together, I thought of putting this together so I can read it because we always talk about causes and conditions, but there is always a lack of words when we say things, if things existed inherently. What does that really mean? You know, it's hard to express that in easy language. It's easy to say things are dependent arising cause, because of course there are effects of things are changing. You can say that easily in English, but then they talk about what is, if it's inherently existent, what does that mean?
Originally, if a dog walks in, he sees a cup. Cup is...
existing. Yeah. Okay, so So it does say here.
Dependent arising says there's nothing being here.
Correct. But the only way you can understand dependent arising, they also want to show you why dependent arising is the way it is and not static. So they want to show you the opposite side sometimes to show that it's absurd. It is just a logical way in a structure. If you say this is right, this is right, this is right, then somebody's going to say, why is it right? What's wrong? So you have to show them both sides. So what they're saying here is, imagine something that produces itself. It's almost hard to imagine. What is there by itself? And it goes on to say, this brings up the absurdity of having to produce something that already exists. You cannot produce something that exists. So in other words, there is no such thing that exists on its own. There is none. So you're right. It's just they have to mention it. So the conclusion is, a product rises not by itself, but its causes that are not its causes, and all products and characteristics derive from the causes. So cause and effect. This is why, so we were talking about how we were, what was our syllogism here? Person does not truly exist because it's being dependent arising. And then we say there's three ways things come into place. Causes and conditions depend on their parts and constructed from words and thoughts. So let's talk about a car. Bring it to a conventional level. Does car exist? So you see a car parked outside, say that's a car. But it is made up of its parts. Right? Steering wheel, doors, wheels, transmission, go for it, many parts. Do you find a car in that part? No. There is no carness in any part of those parts. Car only is a label that we give to this final product made up of its parts. So a lot of these things, when we talk about causes and condition or dependent arising, it breaks down into smaller and smaller and smaller parts. Think about it. Think anything. There are so many causes and conditions for something to be, and causes and effects for thing to be. So that's what they're trying to say, that there is no carness in the parts of a carness. Okay? Then it talks about mere construct of thoughts and words. So then they talk about, let's talk about person. Because a person is a product, a person is composed of parts, a person is a construct of words and thoughts. So then they will give the examples given. For example, what I found was, well, you are not the same person as if when you were a youth. Okay? Maybe you can even say youth was the cause for what you are today. You can even take it that far. You can also say you are a product of your parents. So you are a product. Right? And no person exists if you don't give it a name, person. And you're made up of body and mind. Those are parts. So even that is dependent arising. And that's why they come to conclusion that the person is dependent arising. And there's a lot more to that. But this is just a very quick way, because we've been talking about the same thing in just different ways. So I wanted to bring that about a little bit. So, any questions on that? And then it goes a little further, Nagarjuna's way of teaching of emptiness. There were people who challenged him at times. And why we still follow Nagarjuna is because he was so good at this. And they challenged him and criticized that because he keeps on saying that things don't exist from their own side, that he was nihilistic. And you can understand, when you first start to learn emptiness, your mind was to say, if nothing exists, then what does? That's where our mind initially goes. You don't start to see that dependent arising is the form. It is because of emptiness there is form. You get to that understanding after you read and contemplate it on it for a while. And so this is what Nagarjuna said. Nagarjuna said, things exist because they are empty. So now you have to think, empty, say that word again, nothingness. That's not what we're talking about. Now you understand what is emptiness. Right? You understand the phenomenon of emptiness is what? Right? It is dependent arising. Things come from dependent origination. There are causes and effects that make this phenomena function. And to have a product, you must have a cause to have an effect. That's how things come to be. So if things are there, that means things exist because of emptiness. Right? So it is just a way of saying. So now you understand form is empty, emptiness is form. And that's why he's saying that Nagarjuna said things exist because they are empty, and he used emptiness to prove existence and refute nihilism. And also, the funny thing is, he takes the same word of dependent arising and refutes the fact that things exist on its own, because he's using the thing, if things are dependent arising, they don't exist on their own. So there is no concreteness and there is no complete nothingness. The middle way, madhyamika. Madhya means middle. So follow that. And this was a unique approach for him to eliminate the two extremes, and it turned the arguments on his critics back on them. And they go into further and further into, you can feel, find it when you read it, that if cause is not, if there is no, if there's a cause, effect is still not there till the cause ceases. They go into this kind of logic. And if this one does not exist, then this does not exist either. So how can there be cause and effect that depend on each other? And Nagarjuna said, no. Effect is dependent on cause. There is no cause if effect is not there. So effect is actually dependent on cause. He would turn it around that you need the effect. After the effect takes place, you can call there was a cause. So he would see it in such a beautiful way that when you read it 3-4 times, it's like, oh, that makes sense now. That makes sense now. But you want to do some more reading because if you're really into understanding how Nagarjuna came to why we follow and why Prasangika view is so important, is you'll see it's very solid and thorough on this stuff, okay? See, he says here, a thing is not identified as a cause unless it's able to produce an effect. Therefore, cause depends on its effect. Makes sense? And while a lot of logicians would say, if this doesn't exist, then how can that exist and all that? But they don't see the relationships. Okay? All right. What else? We can go further into understanding of dependent arising, but I think, are there any questions on dependent arising and cause and effect?
No, it's just that every single little thing
So, you know, in conclusion, it says here, summary, Nagarjuna said, emptiness to prove the existence and to refute nihilism. He used emptiness to refute extreme of non-existence. For that, nihilism. He used dependent arising to refute extreme of inherent existence. It's just a different way of putting it, right? Okay, so, and there's an example of planting a tree, and the tree abides in a seed, and we see a tree there, but it's not there till it grows, and gets all this, they get, but we've gone through many examples. You always think about all the examples of the cup, and the rainbow, and the Harry Potter, and we can go on and on and on, the blade of grass. You can start to see causes and conditions happening. Also, how mind makes up things from thoughts and projections, like Harry Potter, that's not there. And nowhere does it say that things don't exist. It's just that we don't realize how they exist, that they're dependent arising. If you can walk away with that and contemplate on it, you've taken a big step in understanding the concept of emptiness. Right?
So if there's two wings of the bird, compassion and wisdom, is there a way that compassion informs wisdom, or what's the connection?
Well, there is a relationship, right? Now, we can talk about virtuous actions are causes, and what is the effect? Virtuous, right? Whatever you do, there's an effect of that, right? So they tell you, oh, and remember we also passed out that thing, maybe you also want to do for others. We also talk about non-dual, that we are interrelated. We are mother sentient beings to each other. You've helped me, I've helped you. So if I truly want to be enlightened, my innate nature in this life wants to be compassionate, and I want everybody to be enlightened. That is where it wants to go. That is what Mahayana concept is. And it talks about the practice in your daily life is developing bodhicitta.
But couldn't I understand emptiness without compassion?
I think you can intellectualize emptiness without compassion, but you must practice something, right, in order to really understand the nature of the phenomena in some way. All I can tell you is the method side is a practice in the life. Wisdom is a logic side. Okay? And I don't know how else to train that, but everything you read, the first thing they talk about is you want to create, and I always think in this way, this is a personal Haman's thing, is that when I am thinking of others, I'm not thinking of I. Okay? When I'm developing and without real true altruism and I want to help Jack out and truly with heart, then you're doing activities to do others good things, developing schools, doing something positive. What happens is you're not self-focused. So there's some piece of me that wants to go there. And when you do that and you understand the concept of emptiness, how things are dependent on each other,
opposite of clinging.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of maybe open. I realize we're just talking and not, this isn't a teaching part of it, but it's like experiencing the opposite of that self-grasping I could interact with the realization part, not the intellectual part of emptiness.
Right. Well, that's all it is. To me, very simply put, I was just thinking when you were asking your question. No, just that's why I was a little blank there for a second. All I know is that everything, if you look at any tradition, we talk about love. You know, when somebody dies, they see love and kindness. That's the nature of the virtuous, pure way of thinking. And the virtuous things, of course, from karma class, we know that the virtues of body, speech, and mind, and the non-virtues of body, speech, and mind. And we are always working towards karmic seeds, towards virtuous side, so the next lives you continue to partake in dharma and continue to grow till you become enlightened. And the prescription is that while you are living, you practice those positive virtues, and one of the things is consistently talks about developing compassion and kindness towards all living things. And they are mother sentient beings. It's non-dual. We are connected with each other. It impacts us all the time. So more you do it, better you become, and you go closer and closer towards understanding full emptiness. It's all I can logically think.
We take the kindness of all our mothers. And like Lama Zofa Rinpoche says, or a lot of
great lamas, without Bodhicitta came from bodhisattvas. Without Bodhicitta, forget about enlightenment. That's how important it is. It's right. That loving kindness.
And they use the word bodhisattva. Comes from the word that you need to have bodhicitta to become a bodhisattva. And take the sattva out and you're Buddha. You know, it's a progression towards Buddha. It's a prescription to become a Buddha. You must have strong bodhicitta development, or at least a wish. And that's why Geshe La is very kind. And he says, you know, it's hard for us in today's world to kind of think like that. But start with small and try to grow and understand what is empathy, what is sympathy, you know, because you can get into trouble there, you know, and be smart. Okay, so there's still levels of understanding of that, but generally speaking, bodhicitta is nothing but a positive attribute of love and kindness towards others.
Yeah. I read somewhere that it's the essence of Buddhism.
Yeah, it is.
Great lamas, yeah.
Yeah. So it's 8:43, we still have a little time. I want to speak a little bit at the end about that this is a lifetime of practice. Okay? We want to talk about this in at least in a short way, that people have asked questions like, are there any books we can read? Are there any things? Well, I am probably very limited to only prescribing book that is in our lineage of teachings, because I myself don't go and read books on Chittamata and other things. I have a tendency to read Lama Tsongkhapa, if there's a Nagarjuna or something like that, or Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Those are my basic ways of reading things. But they do suggest that you have questions. You must study other schools. There's nothing wrong in learning and finding out. Be careful what books you pick up out there. There are many books and sciences and doctors that have their own little concepts out there. So be very careful, because it can sway you, you know, from different points. But nothing wrong in reading and learning. Also, it talks about, think about emptiness and discuss it with spiritual friends. because there are a lot of questions still, right? You still walk away that you have a basic concept of dependent arising, that things do exist, but they don't exist inherently. We go through examples. We went through history. We talked about how ignorance can be uprooted when you start to realize how things are. We even made a joke about the truth will set you free. And we say that all the time, but that's a fact. You know, when you know things, how things exist, then you don't get emotionally attached and aversion and all that gets. So we went through all of those things. But when you start to get technical about certain things, we need to have that conversation. Read a little more. Do a little meditation. Don't hesitate to say, Geshe-la, can I make an appointment? I have a question. I am not clear on this. Or let us internally have some students connect once in a while and saying, you know, I was reading this book. Can we discuss it? Or we can make a plan together to read a book together. And we all say, let's read 3 chapters. And we'll meet for a cup of coffee and have a little discussion. Because that's where the conversation comes out. And according to what I'm reading, they're saying, you can conceptualize non-verbally many things. But when you have to actually say it, it's amazing how those things don't come out the right way. And that will help you understand how to present and what your true convictions are. It happens to me here. When you sit here, I go through a lot of thinking. I say, I got it. Then you come here, and how do you say that now? Well, how do you link it right? And what if you say it, somebody will take it in the wrong way? Right? It can happen. And as you get good at it, you get better and better at some things like that. But it is a fact. Okay? So then he's talking about make sure that, you know, you also don't read everything at one shot and think you know it. Read it in small pieces. Try to understand it. Have questions. Talk with like-minded people. So then you have a really nice conversations. And that's how you want to bring this in life. It also says make it your lifetime practice. This is not something you come every DB program. You come to 3 or 4 classes and it says this teacher teaches it that way. That teacher teaches it this way. Same concept taught different ways. But you want to get, you want to learn. So you want to grow. You want to actually take another step. And so you want to do some of these things. And it's okay to come to a couple of classes. Nothing wrong with it. But again, the point is that you want to learn and grow. And get an honest feedback from friends. It's okay to talk to your friends and say, you know, hey, tell me. And that's wonderful because it makes you a better person. It's a wonderful way. Then you should meditate on the conclusion. It says you're going to do all these readings, but if you don't meditate, guess what? It's not getting in. And when you are on your last stages, meditation will bring it about in your mind. It becomes a dream. When you truly meditate and contemplate what happens, it comes in your dream. It becomes you pick it up, right? When you just look at it every day, it's like, yeah, and some pieces of may come in. But when you truly, truly meditate on emptiness, then this, and if you've read about it, in small pieces at a time, it will appear to you. And in your reading, Mahamudra, the great seal, Lama Yeshe very nicely talks about how to realize emptiness, the practice. You should read it. If you haven't read it, I would think read it twice. And first time you'll read it through, some words will throw you off. Why is it the great seal? And how does it, he talks about how, what is Mahamudra? And he talks about how to see emptiness. And then he says how to practice emptiness. A very beautifully written. So I would suggest to you that if you haven't, at least it's a couple of pages, it's not a huge book, read it.
Does he have a stereo?
It is in your normal reading.
Oh,
it is part of the reading requirements.
Is there an LYW video?
I don't know. I just read it. Okay? And then meditation helps you that way. Then it says that sometimes you are just not going to get it. At some point you feel like you're stuck. It's not going in. You're stuck in your ways of mind and saying, this can't be it. I got to have it this way. And that's called, you need some purifications. You need some accumulation. And it's sometimes things like this is, oh, come on, merits and purification. There's a lot of power in this purification. If your mind is attached to some emotion that is causing an obscuration, right, something going on at work or home or whatever, when you do mantra, what does it do? It takes you away from those thoughts. it protects your mind. And when your mind is placid, it opens up to understanding. And so mantras will help you. Okay? It's not something you repeat 20 times and okay, it was wonderful. It actually protects your mind. Okay? There is not only solution. There are even Lama Tsongkhapa, once he was thinking about emptiness and he realized he was not getting there. So he offered a lot of mantras and mandalas. He went into a cave and he studied it and he came back and he read a chapter on Buddha Ghosha's writing and next day he was enlightened. It comes just like that. He's like, oh yes, I got it. Okay? He memorized many books. Of course, ethics in the foundation of concentration. We all know it's not the typical ethics I'm talking about, but we all know where our minds go. We are all generally good people, do the right things, we practice. Some of you may be liberated right now. I don't know. But I know typical average person has a lot of goodness, but we once in a while, our mind just goes into that cave or bad place. Right? It does. It's just how we have for eons practice. And all this is saying is that if you truly want to understand emptiness, recognize those things and come up with a discipline. If there is something attracting you that is going to take you away, then you have to discipline yourself to say, what can I find a way so those things are not in front of me? An antidote. You need to find that. It could be anything, right? Could be a type of show you're watching or whatever it is, including all of us. When you are practicing these things and if something takes you to a bad side, you may want to have some discipline to say, let me cut that out. Then it will help you. And that's what they're talking about, in being ethical about it, and you need discipline. Okay? So those are common things that we are talking about. This is a lifetime practice. So people, I really, really appreciate the fact that we went through history and Nagarjuna and ignorance and understanding what this dependent arising is. We had at least Heart Sutra and so many ways we diced emptiness. Now you have a fundamental tool. Now you must think, contemplate and meditate and read. And ask, and all the things we talked about, to take you to a better understanding. And it will happen if you meditate on it. Okay? So, we have some time. We want to do a four-point analysis. Or do we want to... Oh, I do want to talk about something. Before we go there, can I take a moment and read about non-duality a little bit? I do wanted to say this. When we were doing the Heart Sutra, it says that ultimately things are non-dual. It is one taste of one entity phenomena. Okay? So then I question, do I really understand what is duality? And we have some concepts of duality. So I picked up our reading. There's a whole write-up on duality. And I'm just going to read 3 or 4 paragraphs, are small ones. I'm going to read them. It will take a little time to understand them. It's really interesting for me. This is, I will tell you 1 second. It is Lama Thupten Yeshe. Okay, so this is how he talks. He says, the dualistic mind is by nature contradictory. It sets up an internal dialogue that forever disturbs our peace. Okay, we are always thinking, maybe this, maybe that, maybe soon, maybe later. Okay, he goes on like that. So dualistic thinking perpetuates a conflict within our mind. It causes us to be agitated and deeply confused. When we know that this confusion is a result of a mind conditioned by the dualistic view of reality, we can do something about it. Until then, it will be impossible for us to come to grips with the problem because we have not correctly identified the true cause. It is not enough merely to treat symptoms. It is clear that we must completely eradicate the source of the problem if we were to become truly problem-free. Make sense? As our understanding and knowledge of Mahamudra, in this case emptiness, let's think of emptiness because that's what it is, deepens, we shall come to realize that the way things appear to us is simply projection of our mind. For example, it's not a question of whether Madison, Wisconsin exists or not. Okay? But it's whether the way it exists. Again, this is emphasizing the fact we are not saying that we are not here. It is our understanding of how we exist. What is made up of us, right? What makes us, right? So this is again realizing that. It should be clear that this is not the same as nihilistic assertion that nothing exists. We are simply seeking the correct view of reality. I wanted to emphasize that, so I thought of reading this piece of... To clarify this point further, we can investigate the fantasies we project upon our friends and people we live with or meet every day. Our dualistic mind superimposes an attractive or repellent mask upon the presented image of everyone we meet, with the result that the reaction is of desire and aversion arise, okay, which color our attitude and our behavior towards the person. We begin to discriminate. She is good, he is bad. Such rigid preconceived attitudes make it impossible to communicate properly with even our close friends, and much less with profound wisdom of enlightened being of Buddha. The last part. If we persistently investigate the inner workings of our mind, we shall eventually be able to break through the habitual, over-concretized mode of perceiving the universe, and let some space and light into our consciousness. In time, we shall have an insight as to what non-duality actually is, a phenomena. Okay, now I'll cut it short now. So it says here that the vision of non-duality can be so vivid and powerful that we can feel, we can almost reach out and touch it. It is important simply to mingle the mind with the new experience of joy and luminosity without seeking it too much by analysis. We must realize directly that non-duality is a universal truth of reality. It is one. I thought it was just beautifully written. It kind of takes everything in so many ways of what is ignorance, how we label things, how we say he's good, she's bad, because of the bad, because of the emotions and ignorance, and it tells you in the end that this is what it's all about. Okay, it's just three paragraphs, and it's not that long to read, and I thought that was a very powerful piece. And before we do meditation, I also want to read one more paragraph, and I tell you, these things have really touched me, and it's really helped me a lot. And this is Emptiness, Geshe Thashi Sering, which everybody knows. There are five volumes of this. And we talked about dependent arising, the last piece. I want to conclude with this for dependent arising. By understanding that phenomena are dependently arisen, we will be able to dispel the exaggerated notion that they exist from their own side. Clear? Right? At present, we intrinsically hold a sense that objects of our internal and external universe have a concrete, objective reality that they don't really have. We act accordingly then. Understanding their lack of intrinsic reality frees us from reification of eternalism. On the other hand, by having a good understanding of dependent nature of phenomena, we can see that things exist, that they function, that they arise independent of other factors, and so that frees us from nihilism. In wrong notion, all phenomena are non-existent. That's the wrong notion, that nothing exists. And so it tells you very clearly things exist, but they don't exist the way we think concretely. It just supports the whole fact, what we've been talking about. So any question on that so far? Do you at least feel good about, in the five classes, you've captured a lot of information?
Yes, definitely.
Good. That's wonderful. So I can do two things. If you don't mind, it's 8:58. Do you mind sticking around for a few more minutes? We're supposed to go till 9:30, but I was thinking we'll get done by 9 o'clock. But we can do a four-point analysis to really recapture and to, because Geshe-la said that two things, walk away with these two things and make sure people understand four-point analysis. And so if we've done it, but if let's just re-emphasize it again, and we'll, it won't take too long, okay? And then we'll just do a dedication. So get in position. If you're already tired, please don't fall asleep. Just keep last point here. we're going to put all of these things that we've been talking about into this understanding of emptiness, into this four-point analysis, okay? So it even says here as a preface to this meditation, in the part, it's of course everything is divided into what is it that we are studying emptiness. What is the meditation? It's a continuous concentration on this wisdom without any distraction. This is how we want to do it. And what is the deed? We are accumulating merits and wisdom while you realize from the viewpoint of this meditation that everything is like an illusion. Once you are under this influence of these three things, their practice will come even in dreams. Once it comes in dreams, it will become a moment, it will also come at the moment of death. What it comes at the moment of death, it will present in the bardo. Once it presents in the bardo, there is certain to become the accomplishment of superior attainment, and you will become a Buddha. So it's important to understand emptiness. So the first point is ascertaining the non-existence of personal self. The four-point analysis says identification of what is to be refuted or negated. Analyze how one is grasping to the I. Okay? So just keep your mind open, keep your eyes in meditative poise, and just listen, and I'll go through it slowly. So according to Shantideva, without contacting the true existence which the mind has projected, one will not apprehend its non-true existence. In order not to refute too much of the object and fall into extreme nihilism, or for that matter not far enough, one has to fully understand what part of the object is to be negated. It is very subtle, and Pabongka Rinpoche said about this. While you are looking into exactly how the I instinctively appears to you, the I may present itself in various ways. Sometimes the I may be something imputed on the body, sometimes on the mind. This is not the genuine way the I presents itself to instinctive grasping of the I. The body and mind, which are basis of imputation, as well as the person, the imputed phenomena, all merge into this one broad set, the self-evident I. Plainly appears to be something rather more than an idea imputed on this set. It appears instead to be something established as being self-contained, a distinct unit on its own, the self-evident I. It will rise on the top of the mind and body. If the I seems to be like this, you have rightly perceived the way the object is to be refuted appears to you. Once you recognize, it is easy to refute. Determining the mode of existence of such an I, concluding that it has to be either identical with or separate from the five aggregates. Five aggregates, as we all know, form feelings, right? Discrimination, okay, mental formation and consciousness. In general, if phenomena exists, it must necessarily be singular or plural. Generally, this is a full set of possibilities, and if a particular thing exists truly, it must necessarily either truly singular or truly plural. It is quite certain that this covers all cases. The key point should lead you to certainty that if it is neither of these two, it cannot exist, according to Pabongka Rinpoche. So the examining the possibility of existing as one with aggregates. In that case, one ends up with the five, I, or the five persons, asserting the lack of such existence. If the aggregates were the self, it follows that as they are many, the self too will be multiple. Chandrakirti. You should now be clear about the way in which the object to be refuted is supposed to exist. The significance of the way in which the self and aggregates could be established as the one thing is that they would not appear separately to the mind. They would be completely inseparable, being necessarily the same thing. These reasons restrict them to the one distinct entity. Yet the way they appear does not accord with the way they are supposed to exist. This would make them false, even at a relative level. But how could that happen when a thing supposed to be established as true and the way it appears would have correspond, or they to correspond to the way it exists? So it will be pointless to make the distinction between self and the self-aggregates. So then, it should be absolutely independent, unrelated, asserting a lack of such existence. So, now that you are certain that they are not the same, you should feel all that remains is the self and the aggregates to be established as a separate by nature. In other words, when you eliminate the goat and the sheep and the group consisting of sheep and goat and a bull, you are able to point to remaining animal and say, oh, that's a bull. So this is why they do that. So we are segregating that I from the aggregates to find out if it exists. Okay? But when you really go through form, feelings, recognition, and compositional factors and consciousness, you do not, in fact, come to an identity, identify such a thing. According to Nagarjuna, if it were different from the aggregates, it would not have the characteristics of the aggregate. So retain this understanding and its impact on your mind and keep analyzing. Analysis followed by space-like meditation on emptiness. And think things are like illusion. There is no concrete I. Meditate like this for a brief time. And while you are meditating, this is an I which appears to exist from its own side. Right on the top of that, think that the I is merely labeled. Just meditate on the meaning of the I being merely labeled. I is a name. A name does not exist. From its own side, a name is given, imputed by mind. We can completely agree with that. This I is merely labeled. Concentrate on just that. Try to feel that. This automatically eliminates eternalism, the view of truly existing concrete I. Lama Zopa Rinpoche. More extensive. Question yourself. What am I doing now, here? Am I meditating? While thinking of I, part of the mind, like a spy, search where do I feel that I, within the body or outside the body? Now, if you find it hard to pinpoint the I simply from these questions, then use a more forceful means and imagine that you are being falsely accused of stealing in front of your friends. At the same time as this is happening to you, watch the strong sense of I arising. When you think I am not guilty of this, and if you feel there is a self within the body, leave it there and check. Where does it abide? In the head, legs, arm, belly? Where do you feel the I to abide? In the chest? Somewhere from where the desire and anger arises? If you feel this way, it is good to use the meditation to analyze whether that is true or not. Mentally go through your body from the top of your head to the tip of your toes and look for that I. If you can't find it, make a conclusion in your mind and focus single-pointedly on the space-like emptiness of not finding. When the doubt arises, that maybe the I really exists in the mind, then check the nature of the mind. Mind also has parts. It is made out of moments, such as the past, present, and future. Analyze in which of these three moments the real I exists. When you arrive at that experience of not finding, stay in the space-like meditation on emptiness and let go. How does the I exist? By merely labeled or imputed by mind. On the base, the five aggregates, that's all. according to Dalai Lama, on the last part, ascertaining the non-existence of the self of phenomena, that is part of that meditation, our meditation. Here it is what he says. Unconditioned and conditioned phenomena, that is matter, mind, non-associated compositional factors, do not truly exist. All phenomena are dependent on three things: causes and conditions, parts and directions or moments, and mental imputation or label. Then, is everything non-existent? If things did not exist, they could not affect us. But the pain, pleasure, all of these things exist. When with respect to any phenomena, the object designated is sought, it is not found in the place where it was thought to be, exist, or thought to exist. However, that it is non-existence is contradicted by experience. Therefore, since it is the case that the phenomena being sought certainly exist, but is not found under analysis, it can be concluded that it is not established under its own power, but exists through force of other conditions. And what are those conditions? Conceptual consciousness that designates a phenomena. Thus it is inevitably established that phenomena exist to the force of or in dependence upon imputation by conceptuality, that is by holiness. So I want to thank you for your time. It goes into a lot of other details. I think we can stop here. I wanted to go through this four-point analysis and just know what is you're refuting. And all along, it is saying you're refuting the concreteness of I, not the existence of anything. Okay? And that's all you need to understand. And Dalai Lama ends very, very nice that in phenomena, we find out that things come to existence out of causes and conditioned parts in a designated consciousness that labels it. Okay, and it covers up the whole class. And so I want to just do a quick dedication, and I'll just do my own, I just have a very short dedication that let's dedicate to ongoing learning and these classes that we've had and the beautiful company of each other, that we continue to contemplate on emptiness. And I want to dedicate to all the teachers from Buddha, Atisha, Lama, Tsongkhapa, all the teachers that have written the books that we have used, Geshe-la, all the Dharma teachers here in Kadampa Center, Erin, Dana, all of these people that make this happen. I want to dedicate so this cycle continues and our teachers are able to just lead all sentient beings to realization immediately. You know, and so they may continue to teach and turn this wheel of Dharma, and I dedicate all this marriage to them, and I thank you.
The next class is July 9th, and Hemant, we would also like to thank you. We have a card, but I don't like to leave anybody out, and it doesn't always get passed all the way around, so it's going to be in the back. If anybody wants to sign it on their way out, you get a chance, and then we will give it to Hemant. So thank you very much for all your time. The next one is Transforming Problems. The first one's being taught by Steve is teaching the rest of them, but the first one is Don Hendrick. Yeah.